This is Dr. Helen Caldicott, founding president of Physicians for Social Responsibility. It's extremely important and indeed imperative that you all support KZYX. It's one of the few radio stations, in fact, that will tell you the truth on world events and national affairs. Nothing could be more important than this. If you pledge in this drive, you will be given my recent book called Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Consequences of Fukushima. So I encourage you to really pledge big time. Thank you very much.
Good evening. It's 7 p.m. and you are listening to KZYX 90.7 FM Philo, KZYZ 91.5 FM Willits and Ukiah, 88.1 FM Fort Bragg. Altogether, we are Mendocino County Public Broadcasting, member-supported community radio. We also stream on the web at kzyx.org. Stay tuned for Women's Voices. Women's Voices is brought to us by you, our faithful members. Hi, I'm Janie Reisner, and welcome to Women's Voices. We have a very special guest tonight. I'm grateful and excited to have as my guest, physician, author, and dedicated international anti-nuclear advocate, Dr. Helen Caldicott. She is the author of Nuclear Power is Not the Answer, If You Love This Planet, A Plan to Save the Earth, The New Nuclear Danger, and War in Heaven, The Arms Race in Outer Space. Helen was the founding president from 1978 to 1983 of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and she is currently the president of the Helen Caldicott Foundation, NuclearFreePlanet.org. She has been the subject of several documentary films, and from 2010 to 2013, she hosted the weekly radio show, If You Love This Planet. She has received numerous awards internationally, has been awarded 21 honorary doctoral degrees, and was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize by Nobel laureate Linus Pauling. And she is the mother of three children, grandmother of five.
No, seven.
Thanks for correcting me. Welcome to Women's Voices, Helen. I'm honored to have you with us tonight.
Thank you.
The first question I ask my guests, given that this is Women's Voices, is what part did your mother play in your becoming the brilliant and courageous woman that you are today?
Well, my mother was probably the most intelligent person that I ever knew.
Wow.
She didn't go to university. However, when we were young, she would go to the library once a week and come home with a pile of books, like on the Boxer Rebellion, all sorts of stuff, and just devoured them. While we played around, she usually sometimes locked the door and locked us outside. She would be smoking and reading and then would do a bit of vacuum cleaning and read again. She was a fascinating person, and I would read when something happened in the world that was serious. I'd read Walter Lippmann and all the Eye of Stone and other commentators, and then I'd think, I wonder what Mum thinks, and I'd go and ask her. And she was always correct politically about what would happen in the future. In fact, she sort of had a prophetic vision, and I guess I've inherited that from Mum. She wrote brilliantly as well.
How wonderful. How long has she been gone?
She died, well, Dad died at the age of 51 in 1961 of a very anaplastic cancer. In 3 weeks. He built two houses out of asbestos so he could rent them and send us to private schools.
Oh.
And I used to hold the asbestos sheets as he sawed them. I'm sure I inhaled asbestos dust. I don't know how I'm still alive, but I'm sure it's the asbestos that killed him. Well, when he died, Mum just collapsed. I mean, they had a passionate love affair, always, and we were just a byproduct, the three of us, of their love affair. And you know, she went out with a few men, but no one could possibly replace my father. And she had rheumatoid arthritis. She had severe pulmonary fibrosis from the rheumatoid. She started smoking again, and she really didn't want to live. So she died both of a broken heart and pulmonary fibrosis at the age of 58.
Wow. How touching. Really, what a love affair.
Oh, yeah. was absolutely passionate.
Well, what a model.
Yep. Well, I'm divorced, so there you go. I didn't,
well, you...
I didn't marry the right one.
I think the right one's very hard to find.
Very.
Very. Well, golly. So you went off to college and in some way followed her footsteps in learning.
She didn't go to university. She was always a little timid, I think, in a funny way, because she, when I was about 7 or 8, she went to a technical college and took a course in architectural interior design, and she became a brilliant interior designer, but she never sat the exam. So that indicates that she was unsure of herself. I didn't go to college. When we finish high school at the age of 17, we then go to university, and I entered medical school at the age of 17, and it took 6 years, and the government paid totally for my education. No one suggested I become a doctor. I was going to be a teacher until I was 11, and then I suddenly decided to be a doctor, and I climbed into bed with Mum one morning on a Sunday morning, and I said, I'm going to be a doctor, and she said, why? And I said, because I can help more people if I'm a doctor. And she and Dad never looked at my exam papers. I did it all by myself. And
wow.
I suppose there is a model, because my great-grandmother was the first woman in Australia to apply to medical school. And she was rejected because she was a woman.
Mm.
And Punch magazine, that English magazine, had a picture, a cartoon of the Chancellor of the university holding up his hand, preventing her from entering medical school. But I didn't know about that when I decided to do medicine.
Wow. Amazing. What a history. So off you went to school at 17. This is just amazing. And what have you been doing since then?
Well, I waited when I was 23. And then I always knew that as soon as I graduated, I wanted to have babies. So I did my year of internship, and then I married Bill Caldicott, who was then my husband, and I loved having babies. I had 3 in quick succession, 3 under 3, and I guess if I'd had a better marriage, I would have had 6, so which would be bad for overpopulation. Oh, it's a long story. When I was pregnant with my last baby, my husband wanted to go to Harvard to train in pediatric radiology. So being a good Australian wife, I said, well, we can't afford to have the baby in America. And so I said, I'll stay at home. I was, I think, 5 months pregnant when he left. And I moved in to stay with my mother. That was after Dad died, with my two babies and being pregnant. And I looked after her. She was really actually in heart failure at that time.
Mm.
And then I had the baby totally alone. And when he was 3 months old, I took William, and I was breastfeeding him, and Philip and Penny, all under 3, and a dying mother, to Boston. I'm not sure how I had the energy, but but I did it.
My goodness.
And we lived in Boston from 66 to 69. And I said to Bill, can you get me a part-time job at Harvard at Children's Hospital Medical Center? So he met Harry Schwachman in the hall one day, who was one of the pioneers in the treatment of cystic fibrosis. He asked him if he could give me a part-time job. He said yes. So I did work part-time. I'd get up, bath the 3 children, give them breakfast, get to them babysitter by 7:30 in the morning, you know, on a bitterly cold Boston morning, and get to work. I learned then how to treat cystic fibrosis, and it was the most marvelous experience of my life working at Harvard, where I was surrounded by brilliant people who'd written all the monographs that I'd read on blood and heart disease and the like and the like. It was just a stunning experience.
Mm-hmm.
I was there, too, 66 to 69, during the civil rights movement, the anti-Vietnam War movement. Martin Luther King was killed when I was there. Bobby Kennedy was assassinated. Richard Nixon was elected. It was a very potent time in American history, and I watched a democracy in action, and that inspired me enormously. I read the New York Times every day and listened to PBS. So I was tremendously inspired. My mother died just before I came home, and I kind of had a nervous breakdown. I got extremely depressed. We'd had a sort of argument a year before she died, and we never reconciled, and it was just awful. Mm. And so I went home extremely depressed, and then I got a job in a hospital thinking, well, at least I can practice medicine, you know, I was so depressed. And I got a job in a renal unit. And what I didn't know, and the boss didn't tell me, was that all the machines were infected with hepatitis B, and most of the patients were, the dialysis machines. And I didn't know, and I pricked my finger, and I inoculated myself with hep B. And 3 months to the day, I became extremely, extremely ill. And I nearly died in the hospital where my mother had died some months previously. There was one day I was actually dying, and he gave me this Xylo solution, which he'd never used before on anyone, and my pH dropped to 6.9 when normal is 7.4, and 6.9 is incompatible with life. But it's interesting because the next morning I woke up, I'd been so sick, vomiting all the time, like nausea of pregnancy it was for weeks and weeks. I wanted soup when the next morning, so I was saved. And when I was saved, I thought, well, you know, my life doesn't belong to me anymore. I'm saved to do something. So that was the sort of beginning of things.
Wow. Wow. What a beginning. I'm speechless. That's what a journey. What a powerful, powerful journey, and what a strong woman you are.
Well, I wasn't strong, you know, when I was depressed. I was awful. I couldn't look after my babies who I adored beyond my life. I just was hopeless. But, you know, gradually I recovered, and then I read a book called The Female Eunuch by Germaine Greer, an Australian, and by God, that changed my life. Can I do that, be that, think that, say that? And I thought, yes, I can. From that time on, I always spoke my truth, and I never deviated. Yes, that book really, really changed my life.
Wonderful, wonderful. Learning to speak one's truth is an amazing thing.
Mm.
So, you are actually still in Seattle. You've just come from speaking in Seattle.
Yes.
And was there a particular event there?
Well, my book, a book called Crisis Without End, The Medical and Ecological Implications, has just been published by the New Press. I held a symposium last year at the New York Academy of Medicine with that title, and I brought in some of the world's leading scientists, toxicologists, oceanographers, evolutionary biologists, physicians, epidemiologists, and we gathered together for 2 days, and this book is a compendium of the proceedings of that particular symposium. And it's amazing because my publisher, who's a very erudite woman at the New Press who publishes brilliant stuff, said to me the other day, this is one of the most important books I've ever published. And I was really shocked. And she said, and it's very, very frightening. So I'm on a book tour, basically. So I spoke at the town hall in Seattle recently. And then just after me, Naomi Klein spoke about her book, This Changes Everything. And I've done a fundraiser, I met with some funders, and I did a radio show, and then I'm going to D.C. next week, where I'm going to address the National Press Club on the Ukraine and the very scary situation that could induce a nuclear war between Russia and America. And I'm speaking at Busboys and Poets, I'm doing Tom Hartman and various other things for the book tour.
Wow. And did you mention you're going to be speaking at the teach-in?
Yes, I am. There's a teach-in organized by Jerry Mander on techno-utopianism. It's a two-day event with really some spectacular speakers like Vandana Shiva and Ralph Nader and Bill McKibben and all sorts of people. And he invited me to speak there too. And it's going to be an interesting thing because I think I give one or two speeches and then I think there'll be a fair bit of discussion, and there are some really fantastically interesting people who will make presentations. So that should be an interesting weekend, I would encourage everyone to go. It's going to be held at the Cooper Union on the 25th and 26th, I think, of October.
Yes.
Then I go home back to Australia on the 27th.
I picked this up regarding the teaching. It says the tendency to see technology. There is the tendency to see technology as a savior for all problems. A change of direction is required, returning the fate of nature to the center of economic and social decision-making, which sounds wonderful.
Mm.
I want to just say from myself, I appreciate the thrust of this event long in coming. The patriarchal mindset we have been living under for the past 5,000 years has set us on a course for nothing else but destruction. Disregarding the sacredness of nature, the miracle of life, the natural world and all of its wonderful creatures. Instead, they see this world simply as a resource to be used, tortured, torn apart, destroyed, and cast aside in their never-ending fascination with the deadly creations of their distorted minds.
Is that from Gerrymander?
No, that's from me.
Oh, well, you're right.
Thank you.
And it's very much beyond time that women stepped up to the plate, because we have within us the nurturing hormones, oxytocin, estrogen, progesterone. Our bodies are built to create and nurture life. And we're such wimps. So often I'll give a lecture and people come up to me and a man will say something. I said, that's a terrific idea. Why don't you run for Congress? And he'll stick his chest out and say, yes. A woman will have a similarly good idea, and I'll say, you must run for Congress, and she'll take literally three steps backward and say, who, me? And really, we are pathetic, and we're highly intelligent. The corpus callosum between the right and left brains is larger in women than men, so we're much more intuitive and in touch with our emotions and feelings than men, and we're also highly intelligent. I'm generalizing, of course. And it's time we took over. You know, I get terribly fed up with looking at pictures of Congress, and they're all sitting there with their ties, which sort of to me is kind of similar to their penises. And where are the women? There are one or two, and it's ridiculous. You know, why is there a killer on a horse in every square in Europe, and they're all men? What are all the statues about? They're all men. And, you know, we are extremely creative, and we can be incredibly powerful. And so my next book is going to be called Why Men Kill and Why Women Let Them. And I'm going to try and get in to the cause of the pathology infecting the planet, which is killing. And unless we stop killing now, we're going to blow ourselves up. There's absolutely no doubt about that. We will use nuclear weapons and destroy the Earth. So it can't be more timely, this book. It's going to be provocative. People don't like it when I talk about it in a meeting. You know, men stand up and get all hurt and offended. And I say, look, sit down, man. This has nothing to do with you. This is a generic problem. And then a woman will get up and try and support him. And I say, sit down, woman. Leave him alone. Look after himself. So it's a very fascinating psychological situation where we're brought up to maintain these rigid roles, which are so inappropriate now for the future of life on Earth. And as we discovered the cause for poliomyelitis, Jonas Salk and John Enders, then we were able to immunize people and prevent the disease. And that's called discovering the etiology or cause of the disease. So I'm going to be exploring, you know, hormone receptors in the brain. There's been quite a lot of work done on that recently and how it impacts behavior. And then look at all sorts of other aspects of human behavior and war, and why do we glorify war for God's sake? And, you know, this country is really interesting. It's really a communist country, let's be frank, because one half of your discretionary budget goes to the Pentagon and to killing, and a lot of it goes to nuclear power, and it's all socialized. So, you know, and the rest of you poor little people have to, you know, put up with capitalism, which means no one really looks after you at all. Whereas in Australia, we have a free healthcare system, which is of world-class standard. Until recently, our education was free, particularly university. We're starting to emulate you now, which is very, very bad. So we always had a happy mix of socialism and capitalism. And after all, Jesus was a socialist. He said, leave thy worldly goods and follow me. It's more difficult for a rich man to enter the kingdom of heaven than a camel to pass through the eye of a needle. That's it, fair and square. So we, you know, it's time we changed, and I'm going to be looking at all of that and what women have to do if you want our children, grandchildren and descendants to survive, plus the 30 million other species on the planet.
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. As we look over the past, of course, for the last 5,000 years, women have been subjected to huge repression from men. And when they try to speak out, of course, are ridiculed, shamed, or killed. So there's a huge thing to come up against. I've come up that in my own life when daring to speak out, finally getting it through my head, I have a right to speak and I will speak. But that wasn't always the way. In my own life, I've come across that. So I understand that process, but we certainly do. And as I mentioned to you on the, I think in email, I think it's time for elder women. We are the ones. We are the grandmothers.
You bet we are, because we gain wisdom as we get older.
You bet.
And we've stopped producing eggs, so we don't need to reproduce or please men in any way, shape, or form. And we need to discipline them. You know, many of them need their bottom smacked, literally and metaphorically.
They do. They absolutely, shame on you is a favorite. How dare you? Absolutely. And we have, it's our responsibility to.
Of course.
If we love.
We must take our rightful place, and no one will do that for us. We've got to do it for ourselves.
That's right. That's right.
Realize that each person can be as powerful as the most powerful person who ever lived.
Sometimes it's hard to figure out where you might do that. But I think one of the things as a woman to think about is you can speak up any place. Anytime a conversation goes that you feel is not showing the whole truth, it's right to speak up.
Well, it's imperative. Not just right, it's imperative.
Yes,
you
it
must
is.
Never let anything go that's wrong, and you must intervene and speak your truth. That's it. Now, people call me courageous after they hear a lecture, but I'm only just speaking the truth like I do with a patient, you know. We are obliged to tell the patients the truth about their disease, their treatment, their prognosis, the whole thing. So when I speak to an audience, I establish really a doctor-patient relationship with them and work with them in that way, and I'm not courageous at all. I'm just speaking the truth. Speaking the truth is not courageous. Doesn't take courage unless you have this awful innate need to be approved of, have your teeth all straightened, say, have a nice day, and all that rhubarb stuff. Don't do that. Only speak your truth, and don't conform. Just be who you are, and that's the most potent, powerful symbol that you can have to show others, and then you'll become a true leader.
Yeah, right. Yes, indeed. I just got your book. It just arrived in the mail today, and it's beautiful. I like it. It's beautiful. The beautiful cover, black and white, stunning.
With the beautiful Japanese baby.
Yes, 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 yes. Dear me, yes. And it's, of course, I hadn't had a chance to read it, but it's very readable. This is what's so, the print is large enough to read. And it's so important.
Yeah, especially for older ones.
Yes, yes, really. But truly. So I'm looking forward to reading it. And let's see. I'll read from the back from Maud Barlow. If ever there was a call to shut down nuclear power plants around the world, this book is it. Helen Caldicott has assembled experts in the field who tell us with one voice that there is no such thing as safe nuclear power. If there is any good to come from the horrific accident leading to the meltdown of Fukushima, it is that it must lead the way to a nuclear-free world.
Yep.
And let me see. Here's Ralph Nader. Electric plants powered by atomic energy have melted down in Chernobyl and Fukushima. How many cancers? Uninhabitable regions, and trillions of dollars are you willing to risk before you protest, shut them down, and transit to available, renewable, and efficient energy? Reading this book can turn any indifference into necessary action. The thing that has to puzzle most of us is when all of this is known, the dangers, it's all known, it's all out there, it's not a secret. Would anybody pursue this with any sense at all? How can money be so important?
Well, it is. There's no God in this country. The God is money. Now, as soon as I land in America, people are screaming at me about buying this and buying that, and it's all about coveting my neighbor's goods, or they're sold with sex, you know, as a beautiful-looking woman, maybe with her legs apart or showing her legs or the like. It's really sick. And it's all about money. It's not about caring for people, loving each other, supporting each other. It's about money and greed. And that's got to alter, got to change.
Yeah, it seems, though, there's just no awareness that that life is hanging in the danger.
Well, there's no awareness because the media have been taken over by the corporations who want to sell their hemorrhoid cream and the stuff to stick your false teeth to the top of your mouth and for prolonged erection or erectile dysfunction. I love that word. And then it says if you have an erection for 4 hours, go and see your doctor. It's just obscene. And, you know, when it was first developed, there was a man called Dennis Potter in England, who was brilliant. He wrote The Singing Detective, and he knew how television should be used and would be used. And when he was dying of pancreatic cancer, there was an incredible interview on the BBC with him. In one hand, he had awful arthritis, psoriatic arthritis, psoriasis. He had pancreatic cancer. In one hand, he had a flask of morphia, which he'd take a swig from now and then. In the other hand, he had a cigarette clasp. And he said, dying is interesting. He said, I can drink cream. He said, there's the blossomiest blossom tree outside my window that I've ever seen. And he called his cancer Rupert, after Murdoch. Because he knew what Rupert Murdoch has done to the world, who broadcast to two-thirds of the world's population absolute rot and lies. And the only way to educate people is to educate them through the media, as your wonderful President Jefferson said, an informed democracy will behave in a responsible fashion. So what do? They take polls of uninformed people and then base their decisions upon those stupid polls. I mean, the thing is crazy. We did educate people in the 80s, physicians for social responsibility and many others, about the medical dangers of nuclear war. And when I first came in 78, most people said to me, it's better to be dead than red. And I thought, these people are psychotic. This nation is psychotic. What, you want to be blown up in a nuclear war? Because you don't want to be communist? So I organized physicians for social responsibility, and we started holding symposia on the medical effects of nuclear war in Seattle, in San Francisco, in LA, in Boston, and all over. And it got front page coverage, you know, out to 5 miles from a bomb dropping, everyone's vaporized, turned into gas. 20 miles out, everyone lethally burnt or turned into missiles sucked out of high-rise buildings traveling at 100 miles an hour, having their heads decapitated by flying pieces of shattered glass. And over time, the Americans started to learn, and I was often on television tours, as were many others, that nuclear war is bad for your health and will create the final medical epidemic of the human race. So in 5 years of this intense education and the nuclear weapons freeze, A, we got 1 million people in Central Park in June 82, signaling we wanted the end to the nuclear arms race and nuclear abolition. And B, 80% of Americans in a five-year period became deeply opposed to nuclear war and nuclear weapons. So that, in fact, was the second American Revolution. It was a revolution that was sagacious, peaceful, Gandhian-like, and it happened through education. It was a revolution in thinking, So now we've got to have the next revolution taking over the country from these ghastly corporations who run it.
Yeah, yeah, because it seems people have gotten dumbed down in the interim, probably by media.
Yeah, that's right. Dumbed down. No, you mean they're anesthetized. I mean, when you sit and watch television, your brain waves go into alpha activity. And you know when you're tired and you watch this and suddenly you go to sleep? Because it's a kind of a psychic numbing, a mind-numbing thing, watching television. So it's very, very, very serious. And then we all have to rise up. We have to get ourselves educated, number one. And the only person you can change on earth is yourself. And when you change yourself and your modus vivendi and operation and education, then you become a leader and you start speaking your truth.
I think that somehow, someplace, this is for all of us to wake up and get educated.
Well, not someplace. It is for all of us. You all live in a democracy, yet you don't even use it. You know, you must understand that the people that you elect are not your leaders. They are your representatives, and you are their leaders. Obama is not your leader. He is your representative. If you don't go every week to when your congresspeople come back to their district and your senator and go and see them, make an appointment, go in and see them and educate them and say, if you don't read this book, like Crisis Without End or Nuclear Power is Not the Answer or whatever, I will make sure, personally, you will not get elected at the next election. And then you'll go around a door knock and tell everyone in that electorate what this person is representing. Not you, but the corporations. That's what you do. That's called using the democracy. Tweeting, Facebooking is not using the democracy. It's getting out and using your warm body and convincing and cajoling people about the real truth.
Well, may it be so. You know, the piece of that is that there have been millions of people who have voted against this and that and the other, and the powers that be, the F, whatever it might be, EPA. I mean, they're approving poisonous stuff for us. They're way out of our hands.
Oh, I know, and also nuclear weapons, which could be used tonight because of the situation in the Ukraine, because both Russia and America have over 1,000 H-bombs ready to launch with the press of a button, with a three-minute decision time by Putin or Obama. And this is the first time since the end of the Cold War that Russia and America have literally confronted each other militarily. It is said that Putin's got his hydrogen bombs on a higher than normal state of alert, and I guess probably STRATCOM has too, and no one knows about it.
Yeah.
And if we're blown up in a nuclear war, it's because we're all ignorant lemmings blindly walking towards the cliff of annihilation.
I've got your book in front of me, Crisis Without End.
Yeah.
Could you talk about it?
Well, yes. There was an earthquake off the east coast of Japan. It was a number 9 on the Richter scale, a huge, massive earthquake, which then caused a huge tsunami, 45 feet high, to come into the east coast of Japan. The nuclear power plants at Fukushima Daiichi lost their external power supply. Each reactor, and there were 6 of them, need 1 million gallons a minute of circulating water to keep them warm. So without the external power supply, the pump stopped. Underneath the generators were huge diesel generators, which were programmed to start if they lost external power, but they were flooded. And within days, 3 nuclear power plants melted down, 100 tons of molten uranium into the earth. And there's no way to get them out. It's so radioactive, no one can go near them. Every day since the accident 3.5 years ago, 400 tons of highly radioactive water is pouring into the Pacific every day. And the radioactive elements, cesium, strontium, plutonium, tritium, you name it, are bioconcentrating or magnifying in the food chain by orders of magnitude through the algae, crustaceans, little fish, and us. You can't taste, smell, or see radiation in the fish or the food, and it takes 2 to 80 years to develop your cancer once you've eaten radioactive material. Don't ever, ever, again, eat food from Japan because a lot of the rice is radioactive and the vegetables are radioactive. Don't buy seaweed, seafood, sushi, or miso from Japan. Don't go to Japan. Don't take your children to Japan. And if there's another earthquake greater than 7 on the Richter scale, and there are earthquakes all the time underneath Fukushima, Building 3 could well collapse, taking down with it its cooling pool with huge numbers of radioactive fuel rods, and it would hit and descend into the molten core, and it would be a kind of radioactive volcano. And if that happened, you're going to get a high fallout over here in America. I'm telling my son on the East Coast in Boston, if that happens, he's got to fly with his children to Australia and get out. Because the air masses between the northern and southern hemisphere do not mix at the equator. The ongoing catastrophe at Fukushima will never be cleaned up, will never be remedied. The Japanese government is trying to save TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, so its shareholders maintain their value, and they're using people off the streets recruited by the Japanese mafia to attend to the problems at those damaged reactors. It's an absolute obscenity. Yeah. And it's a public health hazard, a huge public health hazard, which will never end, which is why the book is called Crisis Without End. Mm. Already 103 children under the age of 18 have developed thyroid cancer. The normal incidence is 1 or 2 per million in that population. Yeah. So we're seeing the tip of the iceberg, indicating there are going to be hundreds or thousands more cancers developing in that irradiated population, as happened at Chernobyl, where it's now estimated over a million people have died as a result of Chernobyl.
Wow. Huh. And on the other hand, there we hear that the government wants to start up more nuclear power plants.
Well, that's because your government and your nuclear industry is encouraging Japan to do that. They've got a very bad prime minister called Abe who would like to do that. Japan is a very large exporter of nuclear power plants and all the stuff that goes in the reactors, and they're selling at the moment nuclear power plants all over the world to the United Arab Emirates and Turkey and all sorts of places, which is ridiculous because nuclear power plants are A, bomb factories, and because they make 500 pounds of plutonium each year, and you need 5 pounds to make yourself a nuclear weapon, and it lasts for 500,000 years, and B, they're cancer factories because they're full of radioactive elements which must be isolated from the environment for 1,000,000 years according to your EPA, which is an absolute scientific impossibility. Yeah. So over time, the radioactive waste will induce epidemics of cancers, leukemias, genetic disease like cystic fibrosis, hemochromatosis, and 2,000 others, and severe congenital deformities. Wow. And that's all documented in the book Crisis Without End.
Oh, my God. So we won't even need to have a nuclear accident. We'll all just die anyway.
I'm going to die soon. I'm 76, but it's our grandchildren and descendants. That's what's going to happen for future generations. This is a very wicked, murdering industry. And the people who are doing it should be put in jail, I think, from a medical point of view. But because it takes so long for cancer to develop, and because you have to do big epidemiological studies to find a higher than normal incidence of cancer in the exposed population, and it's expensive, it's not being done. Although the medical literature is replete on data about nuclear power, nuclear accidents and cancer, starting from Hiroshima and Nagasaki, starting from Madame Curie, who died of a form of leukemia because she removed radium from pitch blend, and radium is a very, very poisonous carcinogen. She used to walk around with a little piece of it in her pocket in a lab coat, and when she died of actually aplastic anemia, she had to be buried in a radioactive waste facility because she was so radioactive. Her daughter died of leukemia too. So we've known forever. And the nuclear industry has known forever, and they knew during the Manhattan Project. Yet these men keep going and keep going, and I think they're absolutely psychologically fascinated with the power of E equals MC squared. Energy equals the mass of the atom times the speed of light squared. If you split an atom, you get that sort of energy that's released in a nuclear weapon, and also a controlled energy in a nuclear power plant. So all a nuclear power plant is designed to do is basically boil water. And as Einstein said, nuclear power is a hell of a way to boil water.
Yeah. Yeah. Mm. Mm. I'm speechless.
Yeah.
Really. Well, along with everything else, we've killed, I'm sure you've seen this, we've killed off half the world's non-vertebrate animals since 1970.
Yep.
So.
Yep, it's very bad. Now, look, we can fix it. We can abolish nuclear weapons if only the American people would rise up. Russia won't do it without you doing it first. Of the 16,400 H-bombs in the world, Russia and America own 94%, and they're ready to blow up the world any moment, if necessary. The real terrorists in the world, the real terrorists are Russia and America. That's it. So we can abolish nuclear weapons if we decide. That was almost done in Reykjavik when Reagan and Gorbachev met together in Iceland, and they almost agreed to abolish nuclear weapons. We can close down all the reactors if we decide. You bet we can. We can. And we can stop global warming if we cover the whole of this country with solar panels. Every roof, every house has solar panels, so you're independent from the web, from the grid, and you can sell your electricity back to the utility and actually make money. And windmills everywhere, you can save energy. You waste 28% of the energy that you currently use. You can turn your lights off. You can not use clothes dryers. You can hang your clothes out in the sun, dry them with a nuclear reactor in the sky, and in the winter hang them by the furnace. I mean, I could go on and on. And all of this is in my book, If You Love This Planet. So, you know, we can actually fix these things. It's not hopeless if we decide and if we love our children.
Yes, yes. Well, there's the nuclear thing, and then there is climate change.
That's right, global warming.
And it absolutely has to be addressed.
Yes, and we can fix it. And we can get those blasted politicians to behave themselves, and if they don't, we'll get rid of them. I mean, we live in a democracy. We all live it, and that doesn't mean just sitting there. And if you don't use your democracy, you don't deserve to have one. You know, people are dying all over the world in their countries to develop a democracy, like in Egypt and the like. You've got one. Use it.
Well, I'm not so sure that we do have one.
Yes, you do.
I think Koch brothers.
If you rise up and decide to use it the way I've been saying, you have one. Look what I did. I came to America. I was a young doctor. I was an alien, and I was a woman. And I led the nuclear freeze movement. Randall Forsberg wrote the freeze, and I led it. Yes, you can.
It's a pretty sterling example.
Please do it.
Well, you know, I think you're whoever, what's an
Prime Minister.
Yeah, he's not so good, is he?
He's revolting.
Yeah.
I'm ashamed to be Australian.
And I've been horrified by what he's doing with the coral reefs.
Oh, and everything.
And everything.
Oh, he's horrible.
So how can you work around it? How do you still have what you have? How come
he isn't? Not very bright either.
Well, maybe it's a good thing.
I'm not listened to in Australia. In fact, all the work I did with physicians all around the world won the Nobel Peace Prize in 1985. But in fact, it should have been hung around my neck. A man marginalized me and got it hung around his neck. Had I got the Nobel Peace Prize, I would have much more credibility within my home country.
Right.
And that's just too bad, you know.
It is. Yeah. It's outrageous. Outrageous that happened.
Yep. It was awful.
You know, one thing, speaking of Russia and Putin, I who know nothing about anything, but really, I have been reading some alternative websites, and I'm getting the feeling about Putin that he's not so excited to have war, that he's kept...
He's not. He's being extremely restrained.
The State Department, the CIA, I like him.
That have set the whole thing up and organized the coup d'etat...
To make him retaliate, yes.
And they deposed a democratically elected president.
Absolutely.
Yankelevich.
Yes, absolutely.
Yep. so put in Poroshenko.
So I guess we could be grateful for his cool head.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, by now he could have blown up the world. So he's being extremely provoked. He's a little bit paranoid. He's not a good man. He killed 250,000 people in Chechnya. But he's being provoked by this country unnecessarily. And you don't provoke a paranoid patient because they're likely to do something, you know, extremely dangerous. So that's where we are. And I'm addressing the National Press Club next week, and I'm going to tell them that.
Oh, good. Good.
Yes, you bet I am.
Well, that's wonderful. That's right. You're going to be speaking there. And you are also going to be on the Tom Hartman show.
Yes.
And I don't know what you'll be talking about,
whatever he asked me.
Yes. Well, it's good to just keep you out there speaking.
Yeah. Well, thank you for interviewing me.
Well, let me see. What time is it here? I think we've got a little time to go. If you don't mind hanging on.
I've got actually something important to attend to.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Well, let me see. How are we going to fill this hour in? Okay. Well, if you really must go, of course you must.
Yes, I do actually. Something's happened.
I see. Okay. Yes. All right. Well, I can't thank you enough, Helen. It's just been wonderful
speaking
with you.
Play some beautiful music to people know why we have to save the planet.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Good idea.
Thank you, Janie.
Yeah, thank you, Helen.
Okay.
All righty. Good night. I am going to play some beautiful music. Okay. Thank you.
hearts that are weary. The next step, unable to see. Wondering what tomorrow will be. She reaches out and beckons us on into.
I look forward to seeing you in the future. Hang on for The No-Show or The Roots of the Blues. I'll be back on the third Monday of the month. Thanks for listening. Good night.